From RelicRadio.com, this is Case Closed, 1 hour of old-time radio mystery, with new shows every Wednesday at RelicRadio.com. A quick reminder before we start today, if you enjoy this program and would like to help support it, visit donate.relicradio.com or click on one of the donate links. Your support is all that makes this possible. And as always, thank you to those who have helped support this show over the years. We're going to begin today with crime classics. We'll hear the Axe and the Droot family, How They Fared, from August 10th, 1953. After that, it's Philo Vance and the Deathless Murder Case. That story's from October 25th, 1949.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Highland. I'm going to tell you another true crime story. Listen. A man writing. Listen closely because it's a quiet sound, an intimate sound. The year is 1795, and the man who is doing this quiet, intimate thing is named Peter Droot. He is writing his will, making with goose quill and parchment his bequest to his children. When he is done, unknowingly, he will have made certain the death of his two sons. And now he is done. Now he has made certain. And tonight, my report to you on the Axe and the Droot family. How They Fared.
Crime Classics, a series of true crime stories taken from the records and newspapers of every land from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Highland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. Now, once again, Thomas Highland.
The place is Heidelberg Township, Dauphin County, in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. During the closing years of the 18th century, Heidelberg snuggled against a bend of the Susquehanna. Its chief product was people, who were sent downstream to Harrisburg and overland to Philadelphia. So great was the margin of export over import that I can no longer locate Heidelberg Township on a very good map of Pennsylvania. However, during the time that it flourished, it was noted chiefly for its rocks, which were used all over the county to build churches, sheds, barns, and gravestones. The Droot family lived in a stone house, and Peter Droot was so wealthy that he was buried in a coffin imported from Bavaria, which was decorated with cherubs painted on porcelain and other sad scenes. His shroud was of genuine black Westphalian lace. His lawyer was of 100% Saxony stock and came from Philadelphia.
And to my daughter Elizabeth, I, Peter Droot, do will and bequeath the sum of £1,000. However, the sums I have already advanced to her in the amount of £800 shall be considered a part of this legacy. And to my sons, Francis and Peter, I leave the residue of my estate. But in the event of the death of either of my sons, without issue...
And his daughter Elizabeth, pure product of Heidelberg Township, was moved.
Some father I had, to leave to his own true daughter a measly £200.
You have done a deception to me.
Deception? How?
To tell me you were the favorite of the old man's children and would inherit the money. This is deception, to get me to be the husband of you.
John.
What?
I did not mean to deceive you.
Get thee away.
I begged you to believe me. Get thee from the chair and take my hand.
The likes of you, a spouse to the likes of me.
I'm sorry.
I said it, Elizabeth. Get thee away.
That vile man, that father to me, to have done this to his daughter, that I have to wait until the death of my brothers to get to his wealth. That I have to wait until the death of my brothers to get to his wealth. That I have to wait until the death of my brother.
Yes, yes, I heard it.
And that as each one of them would die, I would get £500.
Yes, yes, I heard it. Elizabeth.
What, husband?
How well do you love your brothers?
Francis is the oldest, and I can recall one day at the quarry when he struck me with a stone. This scar.
And the younger one, Peter.
Who was named for my father, and as cruel as my father, and who became my father's favorite in my stead, who once called me a name I shall never forget.
Were they to die?
I am sister to them. I should weep. In your arms, husband. And you would make me smile again.
Smile now.
In your arm?
Yes.
John and Elizabeth Hower, Pennsylvanian lovers. He, a stonemason who had more epitaphs at the tip of his chisel than any stonemason in the county. She, noted for her scar and her elderberry jelly. The old man just growing chill in his coffin from Bavaria. And John and Elizabeth, daughter and son-in-law, were getting ready to lay the rest of the family beside him.
I think we should start with the younger one first.
Why, whatever are you talking about?
He's better off dead than alive, anyhow.
Why, whatever are you talking about? Put me down. Put me down.
John put Elizabeth down and got on his horse. He rode to Harrisburg at a clip which can only be described as furious. Now, in Harrisburg, there lived a friend of his, an elderly gentleman who distilled things and bottled them. It is said that this gentleman could do a thing with toadstools and snake venom that you wouldn't believe. The gentleman, whose name is recorded in state annals as Uncle Hess der Kleine, was finally ducked in a pond for 12 minutes by the authorities. Well, John bought a few ounces of an essence from Uncle Hess and rode back to Heidelberg Township. And the next day, in the stone quarry, this is what happened.
And how is your brother Francis these days, Peter, lad?
I don't see much of him these days.
He's busy counting his money, I suppose, and yours.
He is a farmer. He farms.
Question, lad.
Aye, John.
Have you had the fancies lately?
How do you know about that?
Your sister, lad. She told me how since a lad you have been seeing strangies and ghosties and whatnot.
And what of it?
Nothing, lad. Nothing.
It is true that I have been visited.
And me, too. But last week I was lying beneath the stars near the barn. There was a wailing, and I look about me. Such a beautiful fancy she was. And she was crying.
Go on. Go on, John.
Of such beauty. And I reached out my hands to her, and her image was smoke.
Wondrous.
I can see her any time I wish it.
How?
I have a thing here, a potion, a small bottle of it. Prepared specially to lie under the stars to see this wondrous, beautiful lady.
Was she indeed so beautiful?
I am unschooled. I have not the words for her beauty.
Please.
What, lad?
Give me of that vial. Let me taste.
She stirs your imagination, lad.
Yes, oh yes.
You can almost see her in your mind now, can you not?
Even while you talk, I try to imagine her. Please, give me of the vial.
Here, drink it.
Yes.
All of it. Good lad. Tonight, lie down under the stars and see what will happen to you.
Thank you, John.
The bottle is good no longer. Throw it away, lad.
Poor lad. 18 years old and given to fancies. Now, all of us know that many lads of 18, even today, are given to fancies. But young Peter Drute was very rich and lived in Pennsylvania, And it was a rare moment indeed when he wasn't beginning or ending a fancy. And two, this, we must remember, was the era of potions to conjure up most anything, from rain to a lady made of smoke. So, young Peter Drute had everything going for him that night. Youth, imagination, and potion. He went out under the stars and lay down near the barn, just like his brother-in-law told him to do. What happened then may be described as a good night in the country gone to waste.
Oh! Oh, my stomach! Ooh! My stomach! My stomach! My stomach! Oh!
Oh! That rooster crowing really upset schedules in old Heidelberg Township that night. People and animals looked out of the window and wondered what ailed that rooster anyhow. It was too early to get out of bed and too late to go back to sleep, so they gave ear to the commotion. Through the din rose the wails of Peter Droop, who had seen no fancies but was writhing with a terrible ache in his stomach. His brother Francis brought him back to the house and applied an old Pennsylvania poultice, which relieved the lad no end. So, the next morning in the stone quarry...
And all that happened, John, was an ache right here. A grievous ache.
Poor lad. Lad.
Yes?
When you lay yourself down under the stars, which way were you facing?
Toward the east, toward Bruder Gansel's farm.
I should have told you.
I did it wrong.
Oh, 'tis my fault. You faced the wrong way. However, come here. Walk with me. Sit yourself down here by this pile of rocks.
Here?
To your left a wee bit. Very good. Now close your eyes and think hard.
Of what?
Of beautiful things. And silently I will say a magical thing. And I will go from you a little and behind you. Peter... Keep closed your eyes.
Say it. Say the magical thing.
Aye, right now. Men, all of you, the lad Peter Drute is buried beneath the rocks. He is dead.
No. No, I am not. The slide of rocks did not touch me. I heard their sound and I leaped and
I... What a relief it is to me. Oh, how happy I am.
But why have we come here, John, to the loft of the barn?
I have another way to show you the fancy.
How?
This rope I have here tied to the rafter. Place it about your neck.
Very well. Do not let me fall, for the rope is not long enough to reach the floor.
Is the rope tight enough about your neck now, lad?
Tight enough? For what?
For this!
John? The rope broke, John. Please don't be frightened. I'm not hurt. I'm not hurt at all.
And as long as Peter stayed alive, John couldn't collect any of the legacy, which is why John sat in a hayloft, head in hand, and pondered. Then John thought about an axe, and he pondered no more.
You are listening to Crime Classics and your host, Thomas Highland. Patrolman Kirk reported in from Box 23 at 1:42, on time to the minute, His next call was to come from Post 7. He never made it. When they finally found him, he had been shot to death. Was it suicide or murder? The steady, detailed work the real police do will again be evident on CBS Radio's 21st Precinct tomorrow evening as the world's largest police force tackles the case of Patrolman Kirk and Post 7. 21st Precinct is broadcast on most of these same stations. Be at Post 7 tomorrow. And now once again, Thomas Highland and the second act of Crime Classics and his report to you on the Axe and the Drute family, how they fared.
A few notes about Pennsylvania as it neared the end of the 18th century. It was already a state to be reckoned with. General Washington had camped there during the winter of 1777-78 at a place known as Valley Forge. In the town of Chester, Mad Anthony Wayne drilled his troops in an unusual manner in the courthouse square. The western part of the state was rife with forests, game, trout streams, and beneath it, the silent flow of oil, to be discovered 50 years later in Titusville, of all places. A dominion of wealth, discovered and as yet undiscovered. Of history, made and as yet unmade. To prove my point, a person by the name of Barbara Fritchie, who was born in old Heidelberg Township, had not quite yet been born. But across the street from the house where Barbara would first see the light of day, where her grubby little fingers would reach for her first needle, across the street lived John and Elizabeth Hower, man and wife. As is our prerogative, let's look in on them.
The rope broke.
What a pity.
It seems I can't kill him. Something always goes wrong.
You always were a hasty man, ruined things.
In the barn this morning, I did everything neatly.
The rope broke.
It was a new rope.
And both of my brothers still live.
I thought of something.
And both of my brothers still live. And both of my brothers still live.
Would you listen, spouse?
I
thought of an axe.
And what did you think of an axe?
How it can smash things.
What things?
Tables.
And cups.
Chairs.
And chickens.
And skulls.
And skulls. And husband?
What?
Will you do it?
It will be done.
By whom? By you?
By a man I know and his friend.
And after it's done, what shall I have?
You will have no brothers.
And in their stead?
Money.
Husband.
Yes?
Lift me. Lift me. Spin me around.
What is it?
To talk with you, Charles.
Come in, man. To talk with me?
Aye. Where's your friend, Patrick?
Has the talk money in it?
Aye.
Before or after the occasion?
A little before and much after.
Patrick. Wake. Wake, Patrick. There's money in it. John Hull.
Aye.
Come into here.
Good evening to you, Patrick.
Now, John Hull, speak to the both of us.
My wife's brothers are alive. If they were to die, my dear wife would receive all of their money.
And, is this the end of it?
A very great sum of money.
And?
And this axe I have brought.
It cuts deep.
Aye.
Well, Patrick? Well, John Howard? Quit. It is enough. For now. Patrick, get out of bed, man.
There were frontiers in those days. As a matter of fact, our country was more frontier than anything else. And the people, those who survived, were the fittest. I would like to describe two fit people of the time. Charles McManus.
Which is my name. I am 42 years old. I stand 6 inches above 5 feet, and my weight is close to 200 pounds. Once in Killarney, I killed a man with my fists. I fled to America. In New York, I killed again with my fist. I fled to the backwoods of Pennsylvania.
Patrick Donegan.
That's me. I'm much too slight to kill with my fists. I must have steel in my hand. There was a woman in Donegal County. Her death brought me here, where I am now.
Very fit persons indeed. Killers, and attuned to the wilderness. They moved quietly.
The older one sleeps there, he said. Hold him, Patrick. And the young one sleeps in there, he said. Hold him, Patrick.
Are you a fancy?
Now we can go.
Now, I'll do the dancing.
Come to me. Come to me.
They are dead. They are dead.
Outside, the night is warm.
And there is moon.
And there will be us.
Gently. In a moment. John, hold me.
They came, the townspeople, and they knocked on the door of John Hauer and his wife Elizabeth. And they brought him and his wife to the house where Peter and Francis Droop were lying. Elizabeth fell down upon the floor and wept bitterly. John sat down and made no remark. And this is the tableau, 1 hour after the murder had been committed. And the townspeople had found that nothing had been plundered from the house. And the townspeople knew that only John and Elizabeth would profit from the death of the brothers. And an axe had been found. And a townsman knew it to be the axe of John Hauer. Then John Hauer made a remark.
I did not do it.
Then they asked him who did do it.
Two murderers.
Two, they asked him. How do you know it was two, John?
I hired them. Hi, what is it? So now it is, Charles. Open.
Who are all these people? What people have you brought with you?
The man holding the torch there is Ebner. By his side and holding another torch is George. And the next to him, neighbors and neighbors and neighbors. They have come after you and after Patrick.
For what?
For what you have done.
For what?
For the murder of the brothers of my wife.
You hired us, John.
I told them that.
Patrick, wake up.
In June 1798, a trial was made, charging the three men and Elizabeth Hower with murder.
I have never been one whose life has been governed by the lust for money. Only love and sweet solicitude for my husband. If it has been my husband's immodesty to have committed murder, I do love him still.
I committed no murder.
He committed no murder, he says. He gave me an axe. He gave me money. I returned them and said, do your dirty work yourself. Didn't I, Patrick?
As sure as you're born, I heard you refuse the man distinct, and I heard him muttering that he'd do it himself.
Gentlemen of the jury, as your judge, I now charge you. The murder of Peter and Francis Drute rouses the indignation of the county. Its atrocity is unequaled by anything of the kind hitherto known in Pennsylvania. The execution of the murders was as horrid as the motives were base and groveling. The keenest sensations must arise in the minds of all good men and worthy citizens.
The judge then went into particular detail of all the evidence that had been given and committed the case to the jury at 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. At 7 o'clock in the evening, they returned a verdict. John Hower, guilty. Charles McManus, guilty. Patrick Donegan, guilty. Elizabeth Hower, not guilty.
I'm pleased. I'm so pleased. Goodbye, my husband.
The guilty were all of them hanged on Saturday, July 14th, 1798. Elizabeth Hower mourned for a respectable interval, then married again to one Obed Fanistock. The Fanistocks moved to Maryland, to the growing community of Cumberland, where they bought a house and a well and sold water to settlers moving west. And it all happened in old Heidelberg Township, which I can no longer find on the map.
In just a moment, Thomas Highland will tell you about next week's Crime Classic. The Droot Family, tonight's Crime Classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. The music was composed and conducted by Bernard Herrmann, and the program is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Highland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. In tonight's story, Mary Jane Croft was heard as Elizabeth and Clayton Post as John. Featured in the cast were Herb Butterfield, Sam Edwards, Paul Frees, and Charles Davis. George Walsh speaking. And here again is Thomas Highland.
Next week, San Francisco Bay, midway between Oakland and San Francisco, on board the good ferry El Capitan. The year is 1870, and the events are catastrophic, as I report to you on the incredible trial of Laura D. Fair. Thank you. Good night.
Academy Award winner Joan Fontaine will be your star in Leave Her to Heaven on Lux Summer Theater on CBS Radio later tonight. You'll enjoy this celebrated story of a ruthless woman who destroys the things she loves. And you like Joan Fontaine in this dramatic role. That's Leave Her to Heaven, starring Joan Fontaine, later tonight on the Lux Summer Theater Show on most of these same stations. And remember, Bill Cullen's Walk a Mile show is heard Monday evenings on the CBS Radio Network.
Just tell her I want her to take some notes later and ask Mrs. Wayne to come in, please. Wayne, where do I know that name?
Mr. Vance?
Oh, Mrs. Wayne, please come right in.
Thank you. It's nice of you to see me, Mr. Vance. I know you're the busiest private investigator in this city, and I had no appointment.
I'm never busy when a client has urgent business, Mrs. Wayne. Oh, won't you sit down?
Thank you. Mr. Vance, how old do you think I am?
I beg your pardon.
I asked you how old you thought I might be.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Wayne. The question is leading, and the answer might be incriminating.
I can't possibly be that old. Oh, by the way, you recognize my name.
Wayne, I was trying to place it, but...
I'm Edward J. Wayne's widow.
Oh, yes, of course. He died last year, leaving well over $1 million to you, didn't he?
Yes. He was twice my age, but we were very much attached to each other.
I don't doubt that you were, Mrs. Wayne. Now, please tell me just what is the urgency in your call.
Vance, I'm 31 years old.
Well, that's hardly the urgent age.
It isn't. The point of my coming here is that I want to stay 31.
Well, the man who mixes the magic medicine is out, Mr. Wayne.
I didn't expect you could help me on that score. But there's a man who says he can. A man who insists he can keep me 31 for as long as he likes.
Really? Who is this wonder worker?
His name is John Bell, and he wants $100,000 for his secret.
Well, it would be well worth it if he could do what he claims. What gives you the idea that there's anything at all in what he says he can do?
I have the best reason in the world, Vance.
Yes?
John Bell looks 40, but I have definite proof that he's over 400 years old.
Gee, this sure is a classy-looking joint.
You like it, do you?
I never saw anything like it outside a museum. Gee, where'd you get all that stuff, Johnny? The battle axes and those spears and everything. Did you buy them?
Sam, I didn't invite you up here to my apartment to have you admire my taste in decorations.
Well, I was surprised you invited me up here at all. I just ran into you on the street. Boy, was I surprised to see you, of all people.
I was a little amazed myself, Sam. Unfortunately, I wish the meeting could have been postponed a month or 6 weeks.
I don't get it, Johnny. But then you always were a strange one. What difference does it make if I met you this morning or I met you a month from now?
It matters a great deal to both of us. There are 100,000 reasons why I wish you hadn't made an appearance at this moment. There's just one reason why you should wish that.
But there is a reason. I certainly don't know it, Johnny. Honest, I don't. Hey, Johnny, what are you doing with that gun? Johnny! Johnny, don't!
Now you know the reason, Sam. A little late, but you know it. You know that because you came along just when you did. You had to die.
Come on, get back, everybody. What do you think this is, a sideshow? Get back away from the body. Hey, Morrison.
Yes, Sergeant.
Get him back.
All right, folks.
Hey, Morrison, come here.
Yes, that's me.
You hear that siren?
Yeah.
Take a look at that car. It belongs to District Attorney Markham. See that he gets through this mob, will you? Uh-oh. Never mind helping Markham. He's got his friend Philo Vance with him. Let Vance push his way in.
Which is exactly what Vance is doing. Hello, Heath.
Hi. Hello, D.A.
Hello, Heath. Vance and I got down here as soon as we could. Who is the dead man?
Who knows? All marks of identification have been removed. He was shot, somebody tossed him face down in this empty lot, just like you see him.
That's what I like about a murder. You get so much to work on.
Since when was that a deterring factor to you, Vance?
It never was. I think I can tell you this about the dead man, though. He was a laborer or a farmer. Worked out in the sun a great deal. Notice his neck markings. It's baked dark red.
Yes, I see that.
He might conceivably have been a farmer. That outfit he's wearing is definitely a Gold City suit. And unless somebody dressed him after he was killed, I think you'll find he's from a small town.
Yes.
Well, I've got to be going.
You going to work on this murder, Vance?
No, Sergeant Heath. Not at the moment. I have a client who'd like me to see a man named John Bell. You know all I know about this murder case. It's not much, believe me, but it's more than I know about a man who claims to be 400 years old.
Please sit down, Mr. Vance.
Thank you.
Of course you realize I know all about you.
In that case, of course, Mr. Bell, you know that I don't believe you're 400 years old.
How could you possibly know I am not?
Logic, the laws of longevity, the complete impossibility of your being that old. How could you convince me that you are?
Oh, I won't attempt to. I think you'll do that little thing for yourself. Vance, did you ever see a room like this before?
Not quite like this. Those antiques are beautiful. Your library is complete.
Thank you.
Furniture and decorations are authentic. That much I can tell you.
And you're right. Everything is authentic. I can attest to that because I didn't purchase these things at stores, Vance. I've kept them all these years.
All what years?
I was born in 1545. Don't look it, do I?
No, you don't look a day over 350.
Nice sense of humor, old man.
Thank you. Bell, do you mind if I ask you something?
Well, please do.
You were born in 1545. What happened in 1588?
A lot of things. One of them was Drake defeating the Spanish Armada. Quite a battle it was, too. Yeah, we didn't think we had a chance.
We?
Yes, I fought with Sir Francis. That was before I came to this country in 1607.
I'm getting to sound silly, even to myself, but what did you do here in that year?
My friend John Smith sent for me. Captain John Smith. He was in Jamestown, Virginia at the time. Quite a man, John was.
You knew him very well, of course.
Of course. There was quite a thing between him and Pocahontas, you may remember.
I remember reading about it, which is probably what you did, too.
Stay skeptical, Van. Please do. And don't allow me to try to convince you. I promised you you'd convince yourself.
Yes, I know. Bell, what happened to Pocahontas?
Married a fellow named John Rolfe. Most picturesque wedding ceremony I ever saw. You should have been there, Van.
No doubt. Bell, what is your secret of prolonging life indefinitely?
I sell that secret, Vance. I'm doing nothing against the laws of this country, merely violating the laws of nature. I have selected 5 women who are willing to pay $100,000 each not to grow old. I guarantee each of them thinks she's getting a good bargain, too.
Have you any proof that you're as old as you claim?
Why should I need proof, Vance? I don't have to convince you. I've told you that. The Marquis used to say that only the individuals involved are entitled to all the details of an explanation. You are not involved in this, Vance. You have to prove I am not 400 years old. I don't have to prove that I am.
That's true enough. And the Marquis, whom you quoted, had a point in his favor, too. By the way, who was he?
Lafayette. I fought with him in the Revolutionary War. Admirable character, Vance.
You fought with Drake in 1588 and Lafayette in 1776?
In the War of 1812, too, but isn't this all beside the point? Believe me, I can prove, if I have to, that I am as old as I claim. But I'd rather you investigated me. It would be so much more convincing to you if you find out for yourself.
Hey, Tony. Tony, we're right.
In here, Pete. Shaving. Come on in.
Tony, I find out what that guy John Bell is up to. I know his whole racket. Boy, am I smart, huh?
No, but you know it's more correct than that last thing you said.
Now, listen. You know the guy is working some kind of racket, so you send me to spy on him. I spy on him. A dame comes to see him, I follow her. She goes to Philo Vance's place, I follow her. When she leaves, she goes home. How's that, huh, Tony?
Great. Takes first place under the heading, so what?
Oh, now, wait a minute. I crawl into John Bell's apartment when Vance comes to see him, understand? I find out the whole gimmick. This Bell claims he is 400 years old, and he's selling the secret of how to live that long to this rich dame, you understand?
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Not a bad idea. Of course, it has to be done pretty delicately. But it isn't a bad idea at all.
That ain't all, Tony.
Really?
Look, I am in this John Bell's place earlier when I see him knock a guy off. Shoots him. I know who the guy is, and Bell says something about being sorry that the guy meets him in the street this morning. I see that, too.
Well, what do you know? Hand me the powder, Pete.
Yeah, sure. Here you are, Tony. Well, how about it? Am I smart, huh?
You're a genius.
Well, what do you see in the mirror, Tony?
My face, Tilted.
Oh.
Notice I'm getting a couple of lines around my eyes.
You must be getting old, huh? Well, we all gotta get old, you know.
Not according to John Bell. Maybe I better see him. I got an idea I can cut into that easy dough he's going to grab. Yep, Pete. Bell's either gonna cut me in, or I'm gonna cut him out.
Philo Vance speaking.
Hello, Vance. This is Markham.
Oh, yes?
Is that a man you thought might be a farmer?
No, Markham. To tell you the truth, I haven't. I've been working on another case. The most puzzling and intriguing circumstance I've ever encountered. I'm almost convinced I know a man 400 years old.
Oh, Vance.
I know how silly it sounds.
It
and
certainly
I said
does.
I said I was almost convinced, remember. That much is in my favor.
Well, let me know how you make out. I called to tell you we checked the clothes the murdered man was wearing. They were mail-order stuff, just as you thought. We're making a little progress on the case, but I wish you were working on it.
I will be if you haven't solved it before I wind up this ridiculous situation I'm in. I'm beginning to dislike myself for not finding the fallacy in the claims of this man, John Bell. But I have an ace in the hole.
What's that?
My old history professor at college, Markham. He knows every date and practically every character who ever breathed between the Stone Age and now. My client, Mrs. Dorothy Wayne, and I are going to see him this afternoon.
I hope he tells you something you can use.
He'd better. Then, after I explode this John Bell individual, maybe I can get your killer for you. I hope to have your murderer at the end of a rope before I get to the end of mine.
This is District Attorney Markham. The murder case the police were on has a relative unimportance to Philo Vance because he is faced with a man who insists he's 400 years old. This individual, John Bell, is trying to sell his secret to one of Vance's clients, and up until now, Vance has found no way of disputing the man's claim. The secret of John Bell, however, has remained protected despite Vance's efforts so far, and who he is, what he is, how old he actually is, are unknown to anybody. Vance and his client are at Vance's old university.
This college was your alma mater, Vance?
They're not bragging about it, Mrs. Wayne, but was. I did an awful lot of studying in this room. It contains practically every reference book on ancient history ever published.
When do you think we'll be able to see your ex-professor?
I made an appointment for 3:00. It's 5 after now. Oh. He'll be here. He's pretty old. Takes him a little time to get around.
Vance, when you saw John Bell yesterday, wasn't there some way you could have tricked him?
Believe me, Mrs. Wayne, I tried. He told me, for instance, that he attended the first performance of Shakespeare's Hamlet at the Globe Theatre in London.
Is that where it was given?
Yes. Just to test him, I asked him who played the leading female role in Romeo and Juliet, the first performance of which he also claimed to have seen.
And did he know the lady's name?
No, but he knew there were no ladies in the theater in those days. The females frowned on the stage until the following century.
Oh.
Mrs. Wayne, that man...
My apologies for being late. My sincere apologies for being late. No, don't get up, Vance. Of course I remember you. Now you sit still. And this lady is...
Professor Claiborne, this is Mrs. Dorothy Wayne.
Very pretty. Very pretty indeed. You've been well, Vance? You look well. I'm glad to see you, and glad to see that you remember your old university. Now then, you must want something, or you wouldn't be here. Now, what is it? Speak up, young man.
Well, Professor, in this library, there must be a book containing little-known facts about English history in the late 1500s and American history in the early 1600s.
Yes?
What book would I look at?
What book? Well, any of several. Henderson's Early British Empire, Jackman's Elizabethan Era, Stone's Early American History, all accepted, authentic, factual, complete with names and dates. Where are you going?
Just over to the shelf. I want to see the Jackson book.
Oh.
Elizabethan era, you say.
That's right. Shelf A, fifth volume in. Three volumes in the set, printed in 1661. And how are you, Mrs. Wade?
Oh, Professor Claiborne, you can be a big help to us, I'm sure.
Well, that's what I'm here for. You find what you're looking for, Vance?
I have the volume right here.
Good.
If we're lucky, I'll find what I'm looking for.
Here. Put the book down on this table. It's too heavy to be carrying around. What are you looking for?
The names of the men who served with Drake when he sailed against the Armada.
Well, try page 157 with footnotes.
Thanks.
That ought to give it to you. Ought to be a drawing of the deck of Drake's ship, too, with some of the crew members shown.
Thanks.
Professor, you have a wonderful memory.
Well, a man has to have something good. With me, it's a memory. You find what you want, Vance?
Yes, here's a list of the entire crew that served with Sir Francis Drake. But I don't see... Oh, brother.
What is it,
find something?
What is it? Take a look for yourself. Ninth name down in charge of quarterdeck.
Yes?
Distinguished bravery during the encounter, Seaman John Bell.
Bell.
That's not all. Look at this drawing.
Yes?
The man in the striped shirt standing next to Drake.
Well?
Recognize him, Mrs. Wayne?
Why? Why, it's John Bell.
Wait a minute. Yes?
John Bell?
Yes.
I'm Tony Paletti. I gotta talk to you.
Step back.
That's a good boy.
What's the meaning of this?
Don't be in such a hurry to find out. Nice place you got here. What's that? Suit of armor?
What else could it possibly be?
You got something here, Bill, old boy. How about this battle axe on the wall? Where'd you get it?
Are you going to tell me what you want here?
Sure. Let's see. I'll start from the beginning. You knocked off a guy named Sammy Meade, a farmer from the Midwest.
Go on.
Let me tell you how I know so you won't think I'm bluffing. A friend of mine saw you meet the Sammy Mead on the street the other morning and heard you make an appointment with him for up here later that day.
Well?
So when you leave Sammy, he talks to him. Finds out who he is and where he's from. Then I send him back to check on you some more. And he does. He sees you kill Sammy. And he finds out what kind of a swindle you're swinging. Now I'm here to cut myself in.
Oh? Yes, that's what it is.
Yes.
You were admiring this battle axe a moment ago. Let me show it.
Don't try to get coy, Bell.
Oh, I won't. I want to show you why I can get away with what I'm doing. You elected yourself my pup. You're entitled to know what's going on.
That makes sense. Only I got a little friend in my pocket that's going to keep his eye on you. An automatic friend.
You'll never get it out of your pocket.
Oh, no, one sock doesn't.
That's all.
Two. A little tougher than you think, Bell. I'm getting up. This time you're going down.
Oh, no. You see, I have a friend, too. This battle axe.
Now, look, Vance, there's been a second murder, and we aren't close to the solution of the first yet.
I know, Markham. And in that situation, you have company. I'm not even close to a reasonable explanation of John Bell, either. But tell me about this second murder.
Well, the victim, we know. His name was Tony something or other. He had a dozen aliases. Last one he used was Paletti. We found him in another vacant lot way out in the suburbs, and he was killed by an axe. Only the coroner says it wasn't an ordinary axe.
Oh? What kind was it?
We don't have the murder weapon, of course, but according to my information, it was a very unusual sort of axe. Quite long, we believe, with a curved blade.
I see. The axe that was actually used is probably at the bottom of the ocean by now. But, Markham, there is just the possibility that the case you're working on and mine are alike.
Really? How do we find out?
You mean, how do we find your murderer?
Yes, of course.
We advertise for him.
Stop joking, man.
I'm not. Not at all.
You're not?
Of course, the murderer won't answer my ad, but somebody who might lead me to him will.
Out here in the office, Mr. Vance, waving copies of your ad in the newspaper. How many are those, Steve?
I've interviewed 9 already without any result. Well, send the next one in, please.
Yes, sir. Okay, Mr. Vance, we'll take you now.
Thank you very much.
Sit down, please.
Thank you very much.
I understand you're here because you sell antiques and you have a collection of early English armor and weapons.
Yes, sir, thank you. Your ad says you were interested in some. Believe me, sir, mine are the best in town.
Well, first, I want to know if you sold something in the last day or so.
I sold a lot of things.
I mean a battle axe. A two-headed battle axe with a curved blade about 7 inches long and a carved handle.
Yes, I did. I sold one this morning. Genuine antique it was. Sold it to a man named... Let me see now.
You've got to remember who it was.
Well, come to think of it, he didn't give me a name.
Tall man, slim, black mustache, very distinguished looking.
Thank you very much. That's him. That's the one.
Thank you very much. You may not have known his name, but you told me who he was just the same.
Well, Vance, it's nice to have you back here.
Thank you.
I understand your client, Mrs. Wayne, instructed you to either prove I was phony by tonight, or she was willing to accept my offer to preserve her age at 31 forever.
Yes, that's so, Bell. Say, isn't that a different battle axe on that wall over there?
Different? How do you mean different?
It isn't the same one that was on the wall the last time I was here.
You're mistaken, Vance.
Am I?
Yes.
I think not. But it'll be pretty easy to tell. When I was here before, I left a little scratch on the handle with my thumbnail. Mind if I look at that one on the wall?
Not at all. I'll get it for you. You know, Vance, I rather liked your being called in by Mrs. Wayne. I want no better testimonial to my authenticity to influence my other prospects than your verification. Here's the axe.
Thank you. Now, I left a little scratch just above. There it is, all right.
Of course it is. If you left it there, it's still there.
That's the point, Mr. Bell. I left no scratch on the axe. You just duplicated with your fingernail a scratch you thought I made because you knew this was not the same axe.
You're very clever, Vance.
I didn't think so up till now. You used the other axe to kill Tony Folletti. Why? Because he knew you were a phony the same as I do, and I can prove it the same way that he could.
His friend came to see you too, Vance. Well, what you know won't do you a bit of good, because I'm going...
Oh, no, you're not! Well, that settles you, Mr. Bell, all 400 years of you.
Better be good, Vance. This is the one explanation I haven't any clue to.
Markham, listen. Suppose you were browsing through an old history book and came upon a picture of a man in the 16th century that looked like you. What would you do?
Nothing except pity the poor fellow.
Seriously. You'd just notice the coincidence, be interested for a while, and then forget it. But not the man we knew as John Bell. He saw the old print in the history book, saw the man standing next to Sir Francis Drake on Drake's flagship, and knew he was the image of that man.
How about the name John Bell?
He did some research. He found, as I did later, that there was a man named John Bell who served with Drake. He was very thorough, though. He got all the names of the men who fought with the English commander and then went through the Revolutionary War record.
Until he found a duplicate name.
Right. He found the name John Bell in both places. Now, that's not too coincidental, Markham. It's a very ordinary name. It was even more ordinary in those days. And now Bell was almost ready for his great fraud.
He must have spent months studying every detail of early English and American history.
Probably, but he had excellent incentive. $500,000 that he knew five women would gladly pay him if he could show them how to live to be 400.
The beautiful part of his racket, of course, was that as soon as he collected, he'd vanish. And there'd be no finding him when one of his victims noticed herself going older.
It was a very well thought out stunt, believe me. Bell's first bad break was meeting Sammy Mead, his first murder victim, Markham. The one whose body you found in the vacant lot.
Why did he kill Sammy Mead?
Simple. Mead knew John Bell back when. Knew where he came from, how old he was, and everything else.
Oh.
Bell had to kill him. But in killing Mead, Bell got Tony Folletti on his trail.
And Tony's friend Pete, whom you found after Tony's death.
Whom I found and who talked. But remember, Markham, that that was after I reasoned out that if Bell had used a battle axe from his wall to kill Folletti, he'd buy another one immediately so that he could dispose of the murder weapon which might possibly incriminate him.
Well, you broke the case all right, Vance. Then I knew you would, you know.
Thanks. There was a time during the case when I wished I knew it. Well, Markham, let's close up shop. It's the end of the day, you know.
The end of the day and the end of the deathless murder case.
From Crime Classics, Philo Vance, Case Closed, and all of the other Relic Radio podcasts at RelicRadio.com. There's even a shoutcast stream there with even more old-time radio, lots to listen to, all supported by you. Thanks again to those who have helped out. Thanks for joining me this Wednesday. I'll be back next Wednesday with another hour of Case Closed.